This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. One of the Democratic candidates for governor says he believes incumbent Governor Bruce Rauner has a low regard for people who are poor, have disabilities, or mental illness.
He sees those things as self-inflicted wounds or a sign of weakness. He thinks they should be cast aside and pushed to other states.
Chris Kennedy tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker he thinks damage to the state's social services is intentional. Find out what it takes to move a canine rescue operation. Colleen Reynolds has an update on Wishbone Canine Rescue that helped place nearly 800 dogs last year. And Town of Normal Council member Jeff Fritzen is in for the traveling Mayor Coos to talk about the Uptown Underpass and the town budget. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's June 20th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Normal Town Council approved more development in the Constitution Trail Center near the AMC movie theater complex and have settled once and for all the community debate, maybe, whether the city should explore an overpass or underpass to ease pedestrian and bike travel across the tracks bisecting Uptown Normal. The community's mayors join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Mayor Coos is traveling, and in the studio for Sound Ideas is council member Jeff Fritzen. Jeff, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
I was about to ask if there's ever been a piece of infrastructure more talked about than the underpass, but then I remembered Uptown Circle, which was certainly generated a lot of community discussion. Do the two share some similarities in terms of purpose and design?
Oh, I think they definitely do. Obviously, like you said, Uptown Circle was a bit controversial in that a lot of people have had experiences with roundabouts, as most people like to call them, and some places roundabouts were successful. Some places they, exacerbated a problem instead of solving a problem. So, that was all understandable. But I think with the confluence of the three streets that we had in Uptown, it was really the best solution. And we envisioned it as kind of a gathering place, but I don't think anybody envisioned it to be what it has become, which is really the focal point of Uptown and the Thursday night lounge about the roundabout. Attitude that brings, the vibe that brings to Uptown, is something I don't think we could have anticipated. Now, with the consideration of developing the property south of the tracks, we were presented with kind of a similar problem. In Uptown, we had the three streets coming together, and how do you move that traffic? Well, now we're talking about moving traffic from north to south, south to north, to make that south campus a viable, developable piece of property. And, of course, we've talked about the idea of putting a new library there and other commercial and residential development. And why wouldn't you want to make the best connection you can between South and the existing Uptown redevelopment? So, I think there are a lot of similarities in moving people and getting people to gather and to utilize what we've invested dearly in.
Creating a destination.
Right, yeah. Right.
Where were you on options as this process began 3 years ago, and has your opinion changed throughout this process?
Obviously, when we brought Doug Farr in to talk about the Uptown 2.0, he introduced the thought of, we really need to—the Uptown 1 has been such a great success. We really need to make sure we connect these things and really open our eyes to a new conversation. This wasn't part of the initial conversation because, what was being considered before and what's being considered now are two very divergent things. So what we're looking at now is a lot more dynamic, and so the conversation changed, and that need to connect the two really became a very important decision. So, it opened our eyes to, maybe we should consider something like that. I think most people kind of went to the underpass idea is probably the best solution. But as I worked through it more recently and you know, observed the drawings and things that the folks from our consultants put before us, I started warming a bit to the idea of a bridge. And I call it a bridge instead of an overpass, because overpass sounds just very utilitarian. Mm-hmm. And a bridge to me was something that could be an iconic structure, something that could really be look nice online and on your website and in photos, and as you're promoting your community, really make it somewhat artistic, even maybe, or just an iconic structure. And so I warmed to the idea of a bridge. But last night in our discussion, I was somewhat aware of this, but I was made more aware of the scope of it, in that a bridge has to be 26 feet above the tracks.
That's up there.
That's way up in the air. The underpass would be 15 feet down. So a big difference when it comes to accessibility issues, which we have to be sensitive to. But also, I think just the idea of that structure being that much higher kind of pushed me to, I think the underpass probably is the best solution. So it evolved.
Was hiring WSP Parsons Brinckerhoff worth the $1.4 million in your estimation to help you get to this point, or help council get to this point?
Yeah. Well, keep in mind, this was phase one. So this is an analytical study of the different options, the at grade, the no build, for one, the at grade, which, you know,
is impossible.
Is impossible. Even though people still want to cling to that one, it's just
the railroads won't allow it.
No, they won't allow it.
And even though that on some level, it may make sense.
Right.
But it's not allowed.
Right. And, of course, then the different types of overpasses, the very simple, just move passengers for Amtrak. Or, since we're talking about developing 8 acres of property, we really need to move more than passengers. And so an expanded overpass, a bridge, and then the two different underpass options. So I think to sort through all those things, we could have done that to a point, but we would all bring certain biases to it. They bring a professional engineering approach to it. So I think this phase one, it may have confirmed what we were thinking, but as is typical when you bring in an outside consultant, it really gives you some confidence that what you were thinking is right. And they can delineate reasons for that, whereas we could just talk about feelings a lot of times.
Right.
That doesn't pay the bills.
So their work is continuing. They're working on an environmental study. What else? What are the rest of the deliverables from WSP Parsons Brinckerhoff?
Well, yeah. So the decision last night really just kicks them into the next phase. And, you know, we obviously haven't gotten our $1.5 million worth yet, but we will, because you can imagine the intricacy of going underneath a railroad. So, yes, the environmental impacts, those all have to be satisfied. But they also will. They won't actually develop final construction drawings, but they'll get really close to that. And that's a huge expense in a project such as this. And the thing I think a lot of people don't realize, other than those who maybe were more intimately involved with the College Avenue Railroad crossing, where when you get down underground around railroads, there is a lot of infrastructure. And, you know, there's local infrastructure, but there are also fiber optic lines and other things the railroad has allowed to come in to use there right away. And so, it's a delicate thing.
What do you want to tell people? You know, some of the chatter on our Facebook page has been, I can't imagine using this at night. Why are we making women from ISU walk this tunnel? Or what in the world are we going to do about water management? You know, these people have said, I've never seen a tunnel that didn't. Get flooded or retain water. I assume these are issues that WSP Parsons Brinckerhoff is addressing.
Well, I'm sure they will address them. But just take a look locally. I mean, Illinois State and IDOT and whatever, you know, we have a big underpass under Main Street, and not that it's never been without some safety issue, but what area of the community, even out in the open, is never without some safety issue? You know, so there. I think it, as you light it, as the traffic goes through it, as people use it, I think the public safety issue is something you have to take seriously. But I don't think it's something that should prevent you from doing that. You know, on the trail, you have a couple of tunnels. On the Constitution Trail, trail closes at dusk, you know, so people, and as trail users, pedestrians and cyclists and whatever, not passengers necessarily, but as trail users, the usage of this underpass will diminish as the evening goes on. And yet with the amount of traffic, the public use of the Circle and Uptown and regular passengers passing through that area with probably an attendant or something from the Uptown station actually helping facilitate that, I don't see...
There'll be a lot of people around.
There'll be a lot of people around. That's built-in protection.
And the ISU tunnel under Main is dry.
Yeah. So. And the water, we had a water issue at the railroad tunnel farther west from here that we resolved. So there are ways to work around those.
Overpass versus underpass and how to pay for it became an issue on the mayoral campaign. Let's talk about funding. Mayor Coos says the town is patient when it comes to waiting for federal grants to pay for an underpass. When it comes to construction, is there an appropriate amount for local dollars to be kicked in?
Mm-hmm. I asked that very question last night just to make sure it was explained publicly as best as possible. And our city manager, Mark Peterson, indicated typically we're looking at an 80-20 split. So 80% federal grant money, 20% local. We would hope maybe we could actually leverage more than that. But, that's one of the unknowns. There are several uncertainties about this. We made a big decision last night. I call it a 25-year decision because, what we do today impacts what happens in this area over the next, two decades plus. And so one reason it's difficult to make that decision is we don't have the funding source lined up. But we're going to talk to our folks in Washington. We have a firm out there that helps us make connections. And obviously, Uptown Station is an example of the federal government making good on what they said they wanted to do, and that is, encourage infrastructure construction. And we had a project ready to go, and we got it. And so I think this being, a complementary thing to that is a good thing for us, as we go out there and present our case. But, at least 80% is what we're looking for coming from the outside, and we have to be patient. The money's going to be appropriated. It's going to be spent, and we hope it would be spent here.
You touched on this after the election with a news conference where you took issue with some of the rhetoric in the mayoral campaign. Do you think the town is doing a good job of regularly sharing the Uptown story, how it pays for things like an underpass or the return on public investment, the amount of private investment, sales taxes received from Uptown? Do you think that story is being told well?
I think we can always do better. And we have attempted to up our communications game a bit. With the development of a department as opposed to having just one or two random people doing communications work for us. So we're attempting to do better with that. But, the public, their attention span is interesting. An issue like this or back at the roundabout days, or you want to talk about another bridge, the Camelback Bridge. We had a lot of people that wanted to talk about the Camelback Bridge, and then they had a keen interest in that one thing, and then they went off, and then you have a different group of people that come along that are interested in something else. So I think numbers occasionally play well, but not in the long term. People, it gets confusing if you're presenting too many numbers. I think what has happened over the last 20 years is just the success of things. People have gotten comfortable with the direction we've taken. And then when somebody came in during an election cycle and started, sounding an alarm, where, in my opinion, there really wasn't a need to sound an alarm, all of a sudden people saw numbers that they weren't familiar with and weren't sure how to process it, because they are big numbers. I mean, there's no question about that. They're big numbers. But, big projects require big money, and big money isn't something you can save up for over a 10 or 15 year period, because by then who knows if the project would still be viable by the time you've accumulated the money to pay for it. So you do leverage the community by bonded debt, and we've done it, I think, in a responsible manner. We have funding sources identified for these things. They aren't draining resources from other needs within the community. We're paying the bond debt, through several different tax facilities, and so we aren't robbing money from operational things to pay this debt. So I think we're doing it in a responsible manner.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. In the studio is Town of Normal Council Member Jeff Fritzen, sitting in for the traveling Mayor Coos. Even though the council won't vote on the next budget until March, city staff is already working on it and considering service cuts to deal with flat to declining sales tax receipts and the loss of tax dollars as a result of Bloomington's dissolution of the Metro Zone. Here's what City Manager Mark Peterson had to say during an interview on May 30th during Sound Ideas.
It takes about 4 months to get that process completed, and we present our preliminary budget to the council in January of each year.
So could you put a word on the next Town of Normal budget? Austere, lean?
Yes. Yes, both
of those.
Austere and lean. And in fact, we'll be talking to the council probably this summer, maybe July or August, about some measures that we're going to be recommending to get this on their radar screen so they're prepared when that budget hits their desks in January.
City Manager Mark Peterson from a recent edition of Sound Ideas. It sounds as though you may be faced with some tough decisions come January. What are your priorities as the staff prepares a budget that might pare down some services?
Well, you know, the biggest part of any budget is personnel. You know, any big organization, the biggest dollar impact you can have is in personnel. Obviously, we always talk about, having superior public services. So, and safety, and so fire, police, those things, there's some minimum manning things there that are in place and whatever, so you can't really cut personnel there. Public Works, with the level of service we provide when it comes to refuse collection, brush collection, bulky waste collection, recycling, curbside recycling, it takes a certain number of people to move that every week. And so your ability to impact your budget in a significant way, personnel-wise, is constricted. So I think maybe what we might hear from the staff there would be that as people retire or, leave our employ for one reason or another, we would take a harder look. Staff, we don't do the hiring and firing. The
sure.
City manager and staff does that. So we're a policy body. But I think staff would ask our direction there, and I think what they would probably look at there would be, we're going to take a harder look at whether or not we replace those folks.
So the policy decision the council could make is maybe some sort of hiring freeze.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Something of that nature. And so that's one big area. I think what we did before when our reserves went down, our cash reserves were challenged a few years ago during the Great Recession, we looked at programs within Parks and Recreation and those types of things, and were there things that could be combined or minor cuts that could be made? I just think we've always prided ourselves, like I said, in delivery of exemplary public services, so we're not going to cut anything there. And the optional things do come, unfortunately, in those Parks and Rec type aspects of the budget. We do water, we do sewer, we do all these things internally, and a lot of those are just life, safety, health type things, so you can't cut those types.
Do you think town residents will see any impact in their day-to-day lives as a result of this next budget?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. They're the main contact with the public are those things I described, that weekly public service or, an interaction with a police officer or, your rescue people, those types of things. Those are the people that touch the public the most, and as long as those services don't change significantly, I think the rest of it would be more niche type things that would be impacted.
And what about flat to declining sales taxes? How does a community counter that?
Well, that's a big consideration for us on anything going forward. And when we talk about funding, an underpass or the funding a library or whatever, those are the types of things that come into play, and we have to think long and hard about those, because sales tax is the biggest revenue generator we have, and obviously it has been flat and declining, and nationwide this is an issue. And Bloomington has experienced here recently with business big stores closing at Eastland Mall, and
Normal has Gordman's that closed.
Yeah, we had Gordman's closed, and we had another retailer leave our community for Bloomington, and corporate people are making their decisions based on their needs, and we understand that. And so it's a challenge going forward, but we hear from the developers that, you know, there have been some new owners of some of our larger developments in the community, and they've got plans, they've got ideas, they're talking to retailers. So, you know, our hope is that we get the right mix of retailers to replace some of that, but it's a difficult consideration, something that we talk about regularly.
Okay, Jeff Fritzen is a Town of Normal council member sitting in today for Mayor Chris Koos. Jeff, thanks for your time. We appreciate
sure.
it. The community's mayors join us on Sound Ideas most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Mayor Terry Renner. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. There are a lot of Democratic candidates for governor, at least six at last count. One of them is businessman Chris Kennedy, who was in Normal recently to address a labor group. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talked with Kennedy about his platform. Kennedy says no matter how the state budget finally ends up, a generation's worth of damage has been done to the state of Illinois, its intellectual capital, and its social service institutions.
Well, it's really important to realize that years ago, kids, when they got out of high school or college, moved to where the jobs are. That trend has reversed itself. Today, the big companies, the corporations, they move to where the young minds are, the young people of the next generation. And so the damage that's been done to our state, because we have the largest out-migration of high school and college kids of almost any state, I guess with the exception of New Jersey, is in fact a generational event. It's crushing our ability to compete for new jobs and businesses that want to be around our young people. And the towns that are home to the great public colleges and many of the privates have irreversible damage because of the loss of the great staff on those universities. ISU here has lost 120 slots. They just don't hire. It's not like they fire people and there's a big event, we're all aware of it. It's just a death by a thousand cuts, and that's what's happening. The impact on social services is equally dark, and it's really forced people with any kind of disability in their family to move out of state. And I think that that's not unintended.
Unintended? How do you mean?
Well, I think we have to be conscious that in the city of Chicago, the city is becoming smaller and whiter. And we've pushed a lot of people out of the city. The same thing, which in a city they might call gentrification, is happening across the state. Our state became smaller last year, but it also became 10% richer on a per capita basis. It's not because we all made more money, it's because we pushed the poor and the sick out of our state because, well, they needed to go someplace where they could have access to the social services that we in Illinois were once so proud to provide.
Who intended this?
I think Governor Rauner has really low regard for people who are sick or disabled or suffer from mental illness. I think he sees those things as self-inflicted wounds or a sign of weakness. He doesn't see a role for government in helping people to live as full a life as God intended them to live. And instead, he thinks they should be cast aside and pushed to other states. That's what I believe.
Such damage is not reversible quickly. What are first steps in your view?
Well, I'm very hopeful. To tell you the truth, as bad as Governor Rauner is to our great universities, our surrounding states are equally aggressive in defunding the universities, attacking tenure, and pushing an anti-intellectual agenda. That's good news for us because we're in a great position to attract to Illinois the great professors and researchers from places like Iowa and Wisconsin and Indiana and bring them here. Bring them here with their research portfolios, the source of the new economy. By that I mean the professors have research and basic research, but that basic research almost always sloughs off applied research, which is a business idea. that people can invest in and start small companies and who employ people that pay taxes, that fund local schools, and educate a whole new generation ready to begin that virtuous cycle again and again. MIT alumni alone have founded over 30,000 companies. And we want that for our state, that dynamic. We need to support our colleges and universities so that we, too, can have a growing economy that attracts kids from all over the world.
You advocate a progressive income tax that would require a state constitutional amendment designed to be difficult. How would you accomplish that?
I think there's a lot of support now. The pain and suffering that people have witnessed either directly or through the stories and tales they hear from friends and family members, I think have created a ripe environment to support a constitutional change. I think that people are willing to sacrifice, and they also recognize that when we look around the country at the great economic models of states that are thriving and flourishing, those states have done what we need to do. If we want great outcomes, if we want to be California, we want to be Minnesota, if we want to be Massachusetts, then we need to have a progressive income tax. Otherwise, we're going to be on the road to places like Kansas or Mississippi.
Illinois is traditionally a high property tax, low income tax state. You're advocating a change in that ratio. How do you get that done?
Well, I think that most people recognize that if we want great outcomes for our economy, if we want to keep our children close to homes, if we want to see a future of our state that attracts and retains the minds of our great young people, that things need to change. We need to invest in education. And I think most people believe that the government can invest in the economy that it's part of, but also the people who are part of that economy. To do that, we need to invest in education, K through 8, and then higher ed. We have some of the worst outcomes in the state, in the United States, for our high school kids.
What's the political calculus necessary to get the coalition to get it done, though? For generations, it's been the collar counties won't go for anything different in property taxes because they can fund their schools and still keep a reasonable rate. And downstate doesn't go for it because the ratios aren't favorable. How do you assemble the coalition needed to do it?
I think the answer lies in computational data, big data, and access to information. 5, 10, 20, 30 years ago, an ordinary citizen couldn't figure out what was going on with the property tax appeals racket in our state. Today, because of access to big data, to the ability to create giant spreadsheets to compare the information ourselves, we can all be witnesses, we can all be experts, we can all understand what they told us was unknowable, how these home values are calculated. Now we know with great certainty that the system is a fraud, that it's corrupt, that the outcome of your assessment has less to do with the construction of your home than your access to a great lawyer or whether or not you've made financial contributions to the assessor, his campaign or hers, or their political party.
That's certainly an issue that's alive and hot in Chicago. It's less common for such revenue to come to lawyers who are party-connected officials in downstate Illinois. Why should downstate care about this particular plank of yours?
Because there's no rule of law in the assessment process in any county. No county does a great job. And anyone can prove this out. It's not like you need to take the word of an expert. You can go on sites like Zillow and others that reveal the last 25 or 30 houses sold in your county. You can then compare that sales price to the local assessor's website for the assessed valuation. And without a doubt, I believe you will reveal to yourself and to others the fact that the most expensive houses are always undervalued and the least expensive houses are almost always overvalued. So the system is stacked against the middle class and the poor.
Unpack your fix, would you?
I think there are a series of reforms that need to occur right away. I don't think that an elected official should be in that business. I don't think an elected official should have conflicts of interest. I don't think that that's good government or good governance, and many other places have banned such behavior. We ban it at the federal level. So I don't think a state rep or state senator should be allowed to be in the property tax appeals business. I think the party chair of whatever party shouldn't be an elected official, because then we free each other, we free ourselves to have honest opinions about what is in fact going on.
Even if an assessor, though, is not an elected official, they're still appointed and they serve in a unit of government that is supported by property taxes. Isn't that an innate conflict? How would you address that?
Well, I don't think that conflict is nearly as challenging as the one in which local officials, let's say aldermen, city councilmen, state reps, state senators, fear retribution from a party leader who also acts as an assessor. And makes it nearly impossible for other elected officials to speak out, to be critical of a system, and to act as fiduciaries on behalf of the public. That isn't happening now in our city, in our state. And I think if we can create a system in which we get rid of those conflicts, then the electeds will be much freer to give us a great system, much more likely to embrace a paying for our schools at the state level than through local property taxes.
Some people in the political mainstream in this community on both sides of the aisle have begun talking about, well, lawmakers are not doing their job in Springfield. Most of them own businesses. We should not patronize those businesses because they have not done their job for us. State Representative Dan Brady, Republican in House leadership, represents this area. He thinks that's unfair and ignores the constituent service operation. Do you think it's unfair?
I mean, I would do that on a case-by-case basis. Actually, creating a movement around boycotting the every business associated with a state legislator, irrespective of whether or not they've been trying, whether they've been working hard, whether they're free of conflicts, I think is arbitrary, and it's as arbitrary as the property tax system that we have now. And I wouldn't trade a second wrong for the wrong we already have.
There are some union and party leaders who are gravitating to your primary opponent, J.B. Pritzker, because he's a self-funder, which would free up money that in the existing state party coffers to serve legislative races. That is a callous thing, but it is a practical thing. What is your counter to that argument?
I don't think that they're attracted to J.B. Pritzker. I think they're being pushed there by another force. It's not his magnetism. There's positive and negative attraction associated with any magnetic field, and I think if you want to use that analogy, I would say that there are other actors using negative energy to push people towards an endorsement of Pritzker. The fact is he remains untested, unknown, unvetted, and we should not go into a general election with a candidate who we don't understand. When a guy's two political heroes are people like Larry Dominick from Cicero and Rod Blagojevich, I think we should take pause to make sure we fully understand the nature of his morality and the sort of government he wants. When you're calling Blagojevich to cut a deal and you're using language like, I hear ya, I think it's an indicator that he's willing to go on and preserve the status quo, a status quo that's destroying the future of our state, wrecking the opportunity for the next generation, and pushing those kids to live elsewhere.
And finally, make your case to voters on why you're a better candidate than the other candidates on the Democratic side right now, Senator Biss, Alderman Pawar.
Well, I'd say this. People ought to feel like they know me, that they know my history, in Chicago and the environment that I grew up in that formed my view of government. I believe government's an agent of change, that it can be an ally, that it can help educate our children, keep our communities safe, and invest in the economy that we're all part of. I have a view of the vision for the future to restore the economy by using the great attributes the state already has, its public university system, its amazing tourism assets, the fact that it's the transportation center of the United States, and combine those into a winning economic movement that allows our kids to find good jobs and great careers. And I don't know that any of the other candidates have ever created a job, employed people, built things, and I think that's important.
Chris Kennedy is the son of the late U.S. Senator Robert Kennedy. He's run the Merchandise Mart in Chicago and served as the head of the U of I Board of Trustees. Kennedy spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker at the Marriott in Uptown Normal during a recent Postal Workers Union convention. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. A dog rescue operation in McLean County is packing up its pack of dogs. Wishbone needs volunteers, materials, and would-be foster parents for a move to the former Tri-Lakes Banquet Hall that will offer twice the space for a nonprofit that sheltered and then helped 779 dogs get adopted last year. WGLT's Colleen Reynolds has more in this Sound Ideas profile as she talks with Wishbone Board President Dana Altenberger.
The Tri-Lakes Banquet Hall boasted a big room with a full bar and a lakefront area. It was the site of fundraisers, parties, bingo nights, and wedding receptions for years. Now the Sound of Music will be replaced. Wishbone Canine Rescue at 1303 Morrissey Drive is moving into the former banquet hall because it's outgrown its current location. Board President Dana Altenberger says about 2,400 square feet just isn't enough space, especially for big dogs like Queenie, who is a pit bull mix, and she's been at the shelter for a while.
She's super nice, but I think she's got, you know, maybe dog issues, and she's big. So she's a lot to handle. She's so nice. She's like a staff favorite.
So when you say dog issues,
sometimes, you know, big dogs don't like little dogs.
She seems to like bigger ones a little bit.
Yeah. Sometimes we always have them bring their current dog in to meet at a time of adoption. Or if they, it's usually the dog that's already in the home kind of decides. So we usually recommend fostering for a while to see how they do in the home environment, and then if they get along, then they can always adopt. And that's a lot easier than adopting a dog and not working out and having to return a dog. We had her adopted by a lady who, she was just too much to handle. So she ended up trading her in for an 8-pound Yorkie.
That's a big difference.
She traded her in for my foster, who I was like in love with. So, no, she's been here a long time though.
Wishbone Canine Rescue became an official nonprofit in 2010. And it's founded on the idea that the traditional model of animal sheltering should be replaced by a more compassionate, life-saving approach known as the no-kill equation.
We have a lot of long-time residents here that are expensive to take care of, because when we take a dog into our program, it's a lifetime commitment. So whether they're with us a week or a year and a half, we take care of them and provide everything that they need.
The organization will pull dogs from animal control facilities and other high-kill shelters with the priority of saving local dogs.
We try not to turn any dogs away that need our help. We don't discriminate based on breed, age, or health status of the dog. So that kind of brings in a lot of complicated medical cases to us sometimes. We have several heartworm-positive dogs in our care right now.
But you do have a screening technique. So, for example, if you have a dog that is aggressive, that could be a factor, right?
We take in a dog and then we kind of see how it behaves, and we have it evaluated by our trainer. And we do sometimes rarely have to make the decision that the dog is not safe for adoption. So thankfully those are few and far between, but we do that. But we don't turn a dog away based on someone else's assessment, because we do get dogs that are labeled a certain way, but it just depends on their environment. And dogs are usually at their worst in a shelter environment. So we have them evaluated by the trainer to make sure.
Is he growling?
He's growling. Ears back, eyes wide. He's scared.
The dogs get riled up easily because their cages face each other. But at the new facility, it's a doggy paradise. The grounds have green grass for walks, a lake, and with 5,000 square feet of building space, it's more than twice the size of the building at Morrissey Drive. Talk about night and day.
Yeah, our dogs don't really have exposure to grass right now, so it'll be really nice to be able to have the walkers come out here and kind of enjoy nature. It's peaceful. We're not next to a busy road. Right now, if a dog gets out the front door, there's a big road right there, so we don't have as much to worry about out here. We'll have a lot more room for outdoor kennel space, so they get more outdoor time.
How did this come about?
Well, we've been looking to move for, a couple years now. That was kind of my main goal when I became president, was to get us a new building. And a building became available, and Henson's was willing to work with us, and it's been a really good collaboration. So we're just renting now.
This building used to be used as like a banquet facility.
It's a banquet hall, and so you can see inside, it's just one giant room with some separate areas in the back. And so we had a wall built to sort of separate humans from dogs, because right now we don't have good separation. So it's really hard for the office staff to answer phones, to carry on adoptions, get paperwork filled out. So now we'll have, we actually installed an exterior type wall on the inside with insulation to separate the dogs from the humans. So we'll have a nice quiet working area. And we've been fundraising now for a couple years at our big fundraiser to raise funds. So we're using that now to buy new kennels, to make upgrades to this building. And then we're hoping to start a capital campaign to eventually be able to buy our own building.
The Henson family of Henson Disposal Company owns the land in Altenburger Jokes. It's a great marriage because both Wishbone and the disposal company can be loud and messy.
They're leasing us this patch back here, and they've given us access to the water and all the grass and pretty much the whole building and the outbuilding. So we'll be able to have a separate quarantine building, completely separate from the other dogs, which is great. And we have a really good storage facility shed there that we can use for kennels and crates for adoption events and whatever. So right now we just have like a little plastic shed next to the building that we store all of our stuff in. It's not ideal.
Also not ideal, larger dogs have to be kept in the basement of the Morrissey Drive building, and there are only 11 kennels to hold them. The rest of the kennels can hold only dogs 20 pound or less. Wishbone is going to buy 30 new larger crates.
No, it's just not about having a little bit of space, but we want to make sure they have better quality of life out here and better space. We want to try and give them the best experience possible in a shelter, which it's hard to do. So we're hoping to really increase their quality of life until they get adopted, until they find the right home.
One of the big differences you talked about is a little more space and less need to have dogs even facing each other, which most people would think, well, it would be nice to have a view of another dog or a friend, but not necessarily great for the animal.
Yeah, it depends on the dog. Sometimes, when they're in that cage, they sort of feel vulnerable. And so having another dog kind of look at them doesn't really help them out. Now, some dogs do like to be together, and like we have two dogs in the office together right now. They're kind of hanging out together, and that way we can have two dogs in a comfy sort of home-like environment in the office. But some dogs don't like to be with other dogs, so we need to make sure that those dogs are comfortable too. So it's peaceful out here. They'll have more space. They'll have more playtime. Hopefully, we can entice dog walkers to come out here because they don't have to walk in the highway or on the hot asphalt. They can have a nice, peaceful walk around the lake.
A majority of the dogs taken in are local, relinquished by owners when either they or the dog becomes sick or because of a move or birth of a child. However, Wishbone is connected to shelters within a 100-mile radius, and the organization will take dogs from any place that otherwise might put them down.
So right now, with the dog flu in Chicago, we haven't been able to pull a lot of dogs from Chicago because they have to be quarantined for 3 weeks. But with this space here, we have a separate complete outbuilding that we're hoping to remodel, which we need garage doors for, and we'll have to fix up for the dogs to make that a quarantine space so we can start saving lives up in Chicago.
The current shelter on Morrissey Drive is now closed, as in not accepting any more new dogs in advance of moving day. And Altenburger says It will take a village.
Finishing up painting the big wall that we built, and we need to have doors installed. We need a lot of work moving, physically moving the dogs. So we're going to move on the 28th, and we need volunteers to help us from 8:30 to 5. We also have all that pea gravel that's at our old facility that we're going to have to transport here, so we need help doing that. So if anybody has anything they can help mow gravel with, we'd really appreciate that.
What's the pea gravel for?
It's right now, it's the only outdoor space that our dogs have to run and play and go to the bathroom. So anybody who watches our videos on Facebook, whenever there's a dog playing, it's in that area. So we need to remove all that pea gravel. It's over a cement slab, so we have to get that out. We have to remove the fencing that's out there. We have to move the shed that's out there. There's a lot of work that needs to be done cleaning up the old building. We're also looking for anybody who's a foster or can apply to foster that can take dogs around that time, so we have less dogs to move. That would really help us out. We have to get indoors installed inside. The kennels are starting to get set up. We're going to be in here at the end of the month, and then we're going to probably need more stuff done as we figure it out after we're moved in.
The most expensive item in the remodel, ceiling tiles. Wishbone is still looking for a donation. And all the transfer to Doggy Heaven will cost the organization $30,000. And when it's over, it will be time to... I'm Colleen Reynolds, WGLT.
Find Wishbone Canine Rescue volunteer and donation opportunities at our website, WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. June is National Pet Preparedness Month. A little prep can go a long way during an emergency or natural disaster. Laura Kennedy has more on how to prepare and keep your pet safe in this edition of GLT's Animal House.
You can't control the weather.
Storm is moving to the west. It will likely make landfall.
The winds have gusted to 50.
We just lost power right there. You saw the lights go out. There was a huge flash inside the tornado.
How you react to it is in your hands. And your pets are counting on you to keep them safe during a natural disaster. Don't wait for the sirens to sound to take action. Veterinarian Tim Anderson is president of the Humane Society of Central Illinois. He says, get started right now. Make a plan.
Something on paper that you could kind of review where everybody kind of needs to know what they need to do. They also need to know what their place, what their timing should be as far as, hey, how do we get the pets safely relocated out of the house when we need to?
Put together a first aid kit for your pet. Some of the items to include would be gauze pads, adhesive tape, antiseptic wipes, an ice pack, and a foil emergency blanket. Many pet stores sell pre-prepared first aid kits for your furry loved ones. One thing you should not include in your kit is pain relievers for humans, especially non-steroidal type anti-inflammatories. Tylenol, Advil, aspirin, they can be toxic to your pet. Anderson says part of your disaster plan should include having a supply of food and water ready for your pets. 3 to 7 days' worth should suffice. And don't forget to rotate the supplies every 2 months, just like you do your own emergency supplies. If the worst does happen and you and your pet become separated, a collar and tags can help reunite you. But there's something even better for your pet, especially in the event a collar is lost. It's microchipping.
If that tag comes off, that collar comes off, then you've got a way, if your pet is taken in to some facility, which in the state of Illinois, it is a regulation, it is a law that all of the shelters, rescues, humane societies, animal controls, etc., all have what they call a universal scanner. So that scanner can scan multiple types of chips, because there are various companies that make microchips. You can tell which company it is that made the chip, and then you can call them and find out the information as to who is the owner and what their contact information is.
If the disaster is bad enough to force an evacuation, Anderson recommends you pre-arrange a safe haven for your animal. Many disaster evacuation centers can't accept pets, so you'll need to make other arrangements.
Probably the easiest thing, maybe family first. If you have family members that, you know, would be willing to or able to take in pets, certainly your veterinarian is somebody that you could speak with and see if they have the ability, even the room and so forth, to help out in that situation. There are certainly a lot of even boarding facilities and so forth in town, out of town, or in other locations that would have the room to do so. But again, it's a matter of kind of preparing ahead of time. time and finding out who can do that.
Even with the best laid plans, when all heck breaks loose, soak in your pets. To begin a search for a lost pet, Anderson recommends starting with the rescues, shelters, and animal control in your area. If the disaster is of epic proportions, then a national organization such as the ASPCA may come into the area to assist. You may not have to search too far. Oftentimes, pets become trapped in the rubble of a home destroyed by a natural disaster. Veterinarian Tim Anderson says if you suspect your pet is trapped in rubble, first, be very careful when navigating the area. If it's too unstable, contact the authorities. If you can proceed, bear this in mind. The pet you know and love may not behave as usual, so approach with caution.
Sometimes even the nicest dog or cat in the world is, because of pain, because of anxiety and fear, is potentially going to lash out. You do want to have somebody, hopefully somebody experienced in animal handling that can help with that situation, again, without anybody getting hurt or injured in the process.
The aftermath of a superstorm can be just as upsetting to your animals as it can be for you. If your pet is stressed or anxious, give them a secure place to find relief from the chaos. Anderson recommends a crate or carrier, especially for cats.
Really, after a while, you know, if they've got some bedding in there and some things, they're going to be pretty confined and they're going to calm down with that. Much better than just trying to literally wrap them up in a blanket and hold on to them if they're trying to escape. Because with all of the nervousness and anxiety, even if you are holding them and you're the owner, they may be in a state of mind such that they're still kind of in a panic mode and they're wanting to get away from you.
You can't always know when a natural disaster is going to strike, but you can ensure you and your pet's safety by making plans in advance and keeping your cool in the midst of a storm. For more information on disaster preparedness and your pets, check with the Humane Society. I'm Laura Kennedy.
For more information on disaster preparedness and your pets, go to ready.gov/animals. And if you have a question for any of the Animal House team of experts, just contact us at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can download the Sound Ideas podcast or find individual interviews today from Colleen Reynolds, Charlie Schlenker, and Laura Kennedy. Also, thanks to Town of Normal Councilmember Jeff Fritzen for his time today. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Share your thoughts at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Or tweet, use the hashtag SoundIdeas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLTFM. This is WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.